Hey everybody, this is B. Sal of the Vault of Horror, and welcome to the Vaultcast, otherwise known as Conversations in the Dark. I'm here tonight in the vault. First of all, I'm here as always with Captain Cruella.
Hello, kittens.
And I just want to say that I'm very excited tonight because my guest on Conversations in the Dark is somebody that is a rather mysterious fellow. Who I have spoken to online and been acquainted with as a fellow horror blogger for several years now, but this is the first time we have ever spoken. And for many of you who read his blog, this might be the first time you have ever heard him speak. So I would like to introduce, without further ado, the one and only Pax Romano of Billy Loves Stew.
Hey, Brian. Captain Cruella, how are you guys?
Welcome to the vault.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pax.
For those who may not know, and I'm sure most of you do, but the blog is Billy Loves Stew, which is, if you're looking for it, it's spelled B-I-L-L-Y, loves, S-T-U-E, .blogspot.com. And, of course, I'll put the link at the bottom. But it's an excellent horror blog, which actually does something that not a lot of people out there are doing, you've been doing it for a while, which is focusing on gay themes in horror films.
Right, I tried to do that. That's what brought the what made me create the blog in the first place was at the time I didn't realize there were 600 million other people blogging and about horror, and quite a few of them were also gay. I've learned that now. At the time, I thought I was doing something really unique, but once I started the blog, I found that there were quite a few others, gay men and women who are fond of horror. So it was kind of cool in a way.
Yeah, I think so too. And the title too, I guess, it comes from the characters from Scream, doesn't it?
Yes, it comes from the characters from Scream. My partner and I saw the movie years ago when it came out, and we left the theater, and we both kind of turned around to each other, and, we said, like, my God, those guys were in love with each other, and we just started laughing, figuring that, it seemed like an inside joke to us, that the reason they did what they did, and then I brought up a story about these two guys I knew in college, and it just gelled for me, and for the longest time, I would jokingly said, I'm going to start a magazine for gay horror fans, I'm going to call it Billy Loves Stew, and then when the blog idea came around, I went with it.
Yeah, and I really think, it's a fascinating blog, and I'm not just saying that. I think if you haven't checked it out there, you should, because Pax is a very bright and funny guy, and he's actually got a lot to say about horror films, which not all horror blogs necessarily do. So Pax is one of those guys, and Billy Loves Stew is an excellent blog. And it also doesn't hurt that Pax also knows a lot about wrestling and Sinatra and all of the things that I love.
And he's a really good writer, and his website's really funny.
Yes, and I should say, too, Pax is one of those old-school bloggers who is all about the secret identity. And so most of you probably only know him as a luchador mask floating in cyberspace. So.
That's right. Although I'll tell you, I do think that my cover is about to be blown. I'm not sure if you're aware, but I contributed to a book that's coming out shortly. And when the book does come out, Butcher Knives and Body Counts, all anybody would have to do is buy a copy of the book and look for the chapter on Motel Hell. And if you see that name, that would be my real name.
Yes, which I'm not going to say here, even though I know it, because maybe we can just keep it going for a few more weeks. This is a momentous thing
for
you.
The secret identity,
Pax. It's all going to be wow. This is big. This is like Superman 2. I mean,
Yeah, something like that.
You're just going to have to kiss everybody and make them forget. Yeah, glamour them, exactly. That's great. So, well, what we are here to talk about, believe it or not, is not actually Billy Loves Stew, although I could talk about that all night.
Well, before you do that, I just want to say that I've been stalking you, and I have to say that I agree with you about Rodney Moore. I Can't Believe I Fucked a Zombie is really the best movie title ever. Ever.
I don't know. I happen to be a fan of Night of the Giving Head myself. I don't think anything will top that one.
Sometimes I can't believe the titles, you know. And I'm really getting bothered, though, that, you know, these, when I post, and your listeners may not know what we're talking about, but I often, I try to find X-rated movies that are horror-themed, and that's become a big deal now. And originally when they did that, they would have, you know, people would come up with these really catchy or ridiculous titles. Now they just, I don't know if you saw the latest one, they did a parody of Halloween, and if you look at the cover, it looks like, you know, the original 70 Carpenter Halloween. It just says Halloween, the X-rated parody. You know, they did the same thing with Friday the 13th. They did the same thing with Psycho. And it's kind of, I don't know, just, you know, going that far and to aim something, you know, stay a little more creative, you know? I think they wrote for the Halloween one was The Night He Came. They left the home out of it.
Right.
Yeah, it is. It says The Night He Came.
That's great. It looks very much like the actual cover. Wow, that's crazy. I'm looking at it right now.
We'll get off subject for 1 second, but I'll go right back on our topic, which we haven't started on yet. Initially, the producers of that film apparently posted on their website that if any of the original actors or actresses from the original Halloween were interested in doing a cameo, a non-sexual role in the film, to contact them. And I was like, kind of hoping like T.J. Solms would have done it. I feel like that would have been awesome, you know?
It would have.
But apparently nobody contacted them.
No, I mean, believe it or not, PJ Souls is actually still working these days. Maybe if she wasn't.
I know, but I still thought, or, was there any actress that disappeared, who played Annie?
Oh, Nancy Loomis?
Yeah.
Did she disappear?
What's that?
What happened to her?
No, I mean, she's just not, I mean, disappeared from...
Oh, I thought, like, she
was
literally...
No, not literally seemed like that, you know, but kind of cool for her, but anyway, I just thought that was kind of a funny stunt, you know, and apparently no one flipped them up on it, though.
Oh, that's too bad. It would have been great if Jamie Lee Curtis showed up. And
one of the extras, oh, I played a cop, but then I guess anybody could have said, yeah, I was an extra, I was the guy on the street, that part, so...
She could have shown up with some Activia, you know?
Yeah.
Nice.
But, yeah. Okay, but believe it or not, yes, we are not here to talk about horror pornos. Although, I mean, hell, we could if you wanted to. But
yeah.
But the real reason...
It's fast becoming one of my favorite subjects.
The real reason that we invited Pax tonight to come on Conversations in the Dark is to talk about, actually, one of our favorite subgenres of horror film, which is zombies, although not entirely, because we're also talking about one of our favorite filmmakers, specifically George Romero.
Mr. Romero.
Hey, Uncle George.
Yes, and we love George Romero because he is an intelligent horror filmmaker, which I have to say we definitely need more of.
Amen.
You could say what you want about him, and I mean, I know a lot of people debate his later films versus his older films, but I mean...
Constantly.
The fact is he is a very conscious, socially conscious filmmaker, and there are not a lot of horror directors who are.
I think there's a lot of directors in general, you know, whether they're doing horror or not horror, that are socially conscious today. Except maybe some of the independent folks. But George, yeah, I think it's something. I've always thought that Romero, being a product of his era, I mean, coming up in the 50s and then watching the whole world, the dramatic social changes that occurred from the late 50s to the late 60s, how could he help but not? You know, as an independent filmmaker, and as somebody, I think, driven by his love of film, throw those things in, and you see it start at the very beginning. Unless you're blind, you see it immediately in Night of the Living Dead.
Well, yeah, and he always claimed, too, that a lot of what he did in that movie wasn't intentional.
Absolutely, yes.
Especially having Ben as the hero, he said it famously, that the part was written for a white character, and so that
right.
was not...
Dwayne Jones gave the best
reading.
Audition.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think if that's true, then certainly later on, once he started realizing that he could use those films to say things like that, he started doing it a lot more consciously, like Dawn of the Dead, for example.
But I have to go back to Night of the Living Dead
sure.
for one specific thing in there. Whether he says that or not, there's the final few minutes of the film right before the credits are run, when Ben is shot, and you see the guys come in with those hook axes, and they carry burn him out and burn him in the fire. Those great shots. I remember the first time I saw that film, that you guys got to go into the Wayback Machine. I'm a little bit older than you. I saw that at a movie theater. I guess it was 1970. God, I might have still been in high school. That's how long ago it was. But anyway, I saw it in a movie theater, and I remember those final scenes putting me in mind of the pictures you saw of those grainy photographs of lynchings in the South, or of the police, you know, sicking the dogs on the protest marchers in the South. And I couldn't help but wonder if that was an afterthought, you know, when he was putting the film together. And since we have a black actor doing the lead, wouldn't that look brilliant? Tesla's going to shoot him, and the guys are going to come in and just take his body and dump it into a. I don't know. I couldn't help but see that you know, when they did that. Whether that was on purpose or not, it's just awfully coincidental. I mean, considering the years, what was going on in the world in 1967 and 1968, those final few moments are extremely powerful.
It's very grim.
That's something I see all the time.
Yeah, and you've also got the militia, who are really, like, kind of a bunch of good old boys, you know?
Yeah, the rednecks, yeah.
It really gives...
It's interesting, too, because when they remade Night of the Living Dead in 1990, while Romero didn't direct, he wrote the script, and I noticed that he, you know, again, having an African-American lead, again, playing Ben, and there's one moment in the film where I think is really telling when... the Harry Cooper in that film confronts Ben and says a line to him, something along the lines of, "You don't look much like neighbors." I think that's the line he uses. And I think there was Romero really, you know, approaching the racial divide. Which in the first film, interestingly, even though you have a black actor, his race is never mentioned. It's inconsequential.
Right,
exactly.
To the other characters there. But when he remade it in 1990, when you think we should have advanced as a country all those years later, with your character making, you know, a veiled racial remark in another one. So, just thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways we wound up becoming so overly conscious of things like that, that it's almost like we've taken a step back in a way. I mean...
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not to take it off of horror for just a moment, I've always marveled at the fact that you had a show in the 70s, in those days, like All in the Family, right? Now, a show like that could never be put on television now. It would be impossible.
Exactly, yeah.
And yet, you can have any kind of sexual content you want. You can have, you know, but you can't do anything that challenges those kind of social issues as a comedy. Can't do it. Unless maybe premium cable might be the only way, but even then.
You can do a show, and you can put all kinds of sexual innuendo in there, but God forbid you should actually, I mean, think of Norman Lear and everything he was doing back in the day, with the shows they were tackling subjects like abortion and rape and homosexuality, and not just, and obviously not minding that for laughs, so yeah, we couldn't really do anything like that these days. Somebody would get very upset.
God forbid anybody gets upset, right?
We can't have that.
That's what I love. I love how our culture has become so obsessed with everyone's having their feelings respected. I mean, look, I hate to sound callous, but when did it become so important that no one's feelings ever get hurt? I mean, when did that become such a priority that no one ever got offended? So what? You're offended. Deal with it.
In the midst of all that, you know, we've thrown out just basic common sense.
Yes.
You know, in the mix. So don't you can't say that. You can't say that. As opposed to just the common sense, you know, the old just being decent to each other. God forbid we should do that. But, again, you know, we can talk about TV shows another time. But yes. I agree. Absolutely.
Well, to get back to Romero, I do think that – I don't think he ever intended – or maybe he did, I don't know, but I get the feeling he didn't intend to be a strictly horror filmmaker.
I think you're right.
But he's kind of following the money, you know, that's what he can get funding to make. So his thinking, I think, if I could put words in his mouth, is if these are the types of films that I'm going to be given money to make, well, then I'm going to, you know, make my messages and get my statements across within this context.
If you take a look at the film right after Night of the Living Dead, it was initially called Jack's Wife, and when whoever the money people were had convinced him, you got to change the name of this film because you're known for, you know, that scary movie you made. So the movie was changed to Season of the Witch. And granted, there is a subplot. Basically, it's a story of a housewife, a mixed-era housewife who is suffocating in a marriage and a loveless marriage. And she has all the creature comforts anyone could want, but she, you know, her husband does not love her any longer. Apparently, she doesn't love him. She has a strained relationship with her daughter. Out of boredom, she goes to a new age, a kind of Wicca place, and dabbles in that. But there isn't really anything supernatural. She tends to lose her mind a little bit and go off the deep end, but again, you know, they call it Season of the Witch because it's a Romero film. And I think when a lot of people find that movie, they get very confused, thinking they're going to get, you know, some scary, creepy movie. And then once again, we've got Romero trotting out, like we said earlier, trotting out his social conscious. I mean, about, you know, women this time. I mean, I think that's one of the most feminist-friendly films, and on top of it, it's played like a, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it kind of comes off like the way Al, what was his name, John Cassavetes, the kind of film he would make.
I've never seen that one, actually.
I have. Yeah, I agree. It is very much, it's very yeah, for a woman, and like that time period, it's very sad for her, and yeah, it is, it's like a social commentary on that.
I wonder, you know, it's funny how they made him change the title and all that. It's kind of funny how when he did a movie like Martin, which was more horror film, that they didn't force him to give it some ridiculous vampire title, you know?
I know. I wondered that, yeah. Yes, Bloodsucker of Pittsburgh, or it wasn't Pittsburgh, but whatever the small town that they had set that in, the city that they had set that in. You think he would have done that, but I've got a copy of Season of the Witch, and actually my copy is titled Jack's Wife. It's a bootleg copy that someone gave me years ago, and I think it's one of the, anyone who claims that they, you know, love George Romero really needs to see this film and see this side of him. He did another, actually he did one I think right before that called There's Always Vanilla, which was another romantic kind of, yeah, it didn't do much for me, it was kind of dull actually, but Season of the Witch is brilliant, it's absolutely brilliant, and you know, I think it'd be really great, like when some of the horror blogs in February do Women in Horror, that maybe they can take a peek at this. They'll think they're going to see a horror film, and they're actually going to see something a little bit different. And again, it might not register with this generation. They might not get it. You know, why she feels the way she feels, I'm not sure, you know.
So. Yeah, or they might just be misled by the guy who made the movie into thinking it's something that it's not.
Yeah, I have to say that I did not, I thought it was going to be much more than, you know, more supernatural or more, you know, it's witchy or coven-like, but it wasn't. But I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, and now that I know Brian hasn't seen it, which shocks the complete shit out of me. The man knows every frigging movie, but, and quotes them every day, but yeah, we'll have to visit that movie and check it out.
I'd love to hear what he thinks about it.
Yeah, definitely.
I can't see why not. I'd love to. You know, I mean, when it comes to Romero, I have an interesting take on it, I think. Well, I don't know if it, you know, if he were listening to this, which I'm sure he's not, he might not be thrilled. I feel like somebody like Romero, okay, I'll put it this way. I think as much as I love horror, okay, as a genre, I think it tends a lot of times to attract, and I'm not lumping Romero in here, but I think it tends to attract directors sometimes who are not good enough to do anything else, okay? And I know that's a controversial statement to make.
Yeah, that was pretty out there, wow.
But I think, well, because horror...
Listen to you.
Horror as a genre, the purpose of it is to invoke emotions, right? It's to get an emotional reaction. It's to create a reaction of fear and terror in people. And I think there are a lot of horror films that we love. There's horror films that are superb films. And I've talked about this before, like a movie like The Shining or a movie like The Exorcist or even going back to a movie like Bride of Frankenstein or Psycho. Those are superb films. But then, and they're made by great directors. But then there are horror
directors
films.
Directors who didn't just do horror films either.
Right. Now, and I don't need to get into specific names here and get people, you know, going crazy, but there are also horror films that we love very much, but we also recognize that they're not great films. They're just a lot of fun. It's a very different type of horror film. Now, having said that, the reason I'm saying all this is I think somebody like Romero, and I think part of the reason why he never quite achieved the success that a lot of people felt he should have, is it's almost like within the fraternity, and it really is a fraternity, unfortunately, of horror film directors, he is one of the most intelligent and the most talented and the most kind of, he has the most to say, but I always felt like he was never quite good enough to be more than a horror movie director. Is that awful of me to say?
You know you're going to get a whole bunch of hate mail.
Yeah, I probably will. like he's not...
I, you know what? I can see your point. I don't know that I agree with it, but I can see your point. I can see your point.
You know, maybe it's because he never had the money. I don't know. But, you know, he's not a Stanley Kubrick. He's not a William Friedkin. You know what I mean?
No, but, you know, he started out of the gate with a horror film that, for better or worse, became iconic. And how do you follow that up? You know, what do you do for your second act? I might be wrong, but I can't think of too many directors that made a big mark. Their first big mark was an iconic horror film, and then, you know, it wasn't expectable. This is what you're going to do now, you know?
Yes.
If he had started with a small, little independent film, maybe made a few little ripples, maybe just a crime drama, or say, hey, this guy's good, you know, and then worked his way up to this was his horror film, and then he did his romantic comedy, and then he did his drama, that would have been different. But, you know, he came guns blazing, you know, with this insane over-the-top. I mean, sometimes I think about that, were it not for Uncle George, and that's what I call him, because I often feel like he's, you know, he's an uncle to all of us crazy people that enjoy, you know, his work. But had it not been for Uncle George, I mean, you know, the modern zombie, as we know, would have never existed.
Right, he invented it.
Prior to that, the zombie was, you know, down in Haiti and places like that, and really didn't, you know, really wasn't much of a threat to anyone. So Romero came along and took the whole idea and, you know, twisted it around, and, you know, I'm obviously taking a little bit from Last Man on Earth and I Am Legend and what have you, and,
yes,
you know, going from there. So I think today, especially when there's, you know, zombie movies left and right, you know, these guys should be bowing at the throne of Romero.
And I think generally
that's
they
my
do.
Personal opinion.
No, I agree.
I do.
It's almost like, you know, there are a few genres that are so completely created and invented by one person. You know, it's almost like what J.R.R. Tolkien is to fantasy novels. You know, it's the same thing. Every fantasy novel, whether they admit it or not, is trying to be Lord of the Rings or is in the shadow of Lord of the Rings. It's one book and it's one author that created an entire subgenre. And it's the same thing with Romero. It's one man and it's one series that created an entire subgenre of movies. And it's been interesting in recent years because talk about all the things that he really does have to say and wants to say. It's almost like he's gone through this period of acceptance, of accepting that these are the types of films that he needs to make in order to get his voice out there. Because he was quiet for a long time and he couldn't get money to do anything. And it's almost like he reached a point where he said, okay, you know what? If this is the only thing they're going to give me money to make, then I'm just going to have to go with it. And now he's been making movies left and right.
I know. You know, it's funny because when his last one, Survival of the Dead, I've often thought that my feeling is when I first saw that movie, I said, you know what? Romero was probably sitting there saying, man, I want to do a Western. I loved Westerns.
Yes, I remember you said that.
I want to do a Western, and he went into the Money Man, and I said, Western? Oh, well, George will give you money for a Western, provided you put some zombies in it. And, you know, Romero was like, the fuck? And then he, you know, went home and said, hey, man, maybe I can do that. And so he took the plot. Well, he took his Night of the Living Dead type plot, and then he mixed in the plot from The Big Country. I made a point of seeing before I saw. I actually rented the movie from Netflix, you know, just before I went to see Survival of the Dead. And I thought it was kind of funny. He's like, hey, here it is. This is the Western he always wanted to make.
Yes.
You know, that's the only way he could do it.
Now, why is everybody Irish, though? Is there... Is there a reason
for
that?
You don't have to know this. You don't see this generation, they always have a backstory.
Oh my God.
I always think if you can buy that there are flesh-eating zombies walking around, then you can buy that these people here are speaking in an Irish brogue, and that they're all dressed like, you know, they just came off the set of Stagecoach.
Well, you and I were among the lone voices in the wilderness that were defending this movie.
I know. I love that movie. I think Romero was having a lot of fun. That was my personal feeling. I think he was having a lot of fun with the film. I think he was doing what he wanted to do. I also think he was getting his jabs in ferociously. And one of the things I kept seeing in that film, to me at least, over and over again, was his way of, like, living in this post-9/11. Well, the past three dead films that he did, there's this heavy post-9/11, you know, thing hanging over them, and how can it not be, you know, a country trying to get back on its feet after a catastrophe? Anyway, with Survival of the Dead, he was just thinking that it wasn't about how we survive, how humanity survives, or how we, it's just the point of, like, who's, all right, I'm going to lose my train of thought here, it's not what is right, it's who is right. That's the most important thing. You have these two warring families,
yes,
and these guys are just insane, and they're just going to shoot each other, and they're just going to damn their whole community because I'm right. No, you're right. And when I was sitting there watching the movie, I kept thinking, of like, oh my God, it's like a Tea Party rally. It's, you know, it's all the insanity that's going on in the world. And I think he, you know, managed to put that all in there for us to see. And then the genius of the whole thing was naming it Survival of the Dead, because it's not us. It's you know, it's the bad thing that survives, because we are. And I think that's the thing we've seen in all of his dead films. We are the enemy. We are our own worst enemy. What does the barber say in the remake, the 1990 remake? They're us and we're them.
Right.
Remember when she's walking around and she sees the hillbillies hanging the zombies from the trees and shooting them?
Yes.
I think that was his point in Survival of the Dead. And when I think that title is genius, because you know, he was basically saying they're going to make it, we're not. You know, because
yes,
we've never learned how to pull together as a society. There will always be something, you know, that will stop us, whether it's a religious belief or a cultural belief or something else. So that was, to me, that was one of the things I saw in that film.
Yeah, I mean, I see it too, and I've seen it in the past couple, like you've said. One thing that I notice about Romero is, well, I mean, it's no secret that he is, his politics are very liberal, obviously. Everybody knows that. George is an old hippie. No secret there.
Oh, George, the old hippie.
Well, he is, you know. Yeah. And I'm not, you know, it's not a bad thing, but it's a fact. But one thing I've noticed about him over the years is I really feel like he's gotten increasingly cynical and grumpy, almost, in the message that he's putting out there. And here's what I mean by that. When you look at early Dead movies like Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, the idea is, yes, he's definitely chastising us and saying we need to get together and they're going to, you know, but the idea is we can't let them win. You know, we have to get it straight. We have to get our heads on straight. We have to do that. We can't fight with each other. You know, we're worse than they are and all this. But there's still a sense that we're worth saving. You know what I mean? Once you get to the later movies, he really is saying, and this is where he loses me a bit, he really is saying that the world is better off with the zombies than with us.
Right.
And that's...
Well,
that's
yeah.
well, I have a very biased party here, Pax. But yes, it gets very cynical.
I do see that, and I think his cynicism is I don't know, I can see why he would be so cynical, because, again, we go back to, he was an old hippie, and he saw the social changes happening in the 60s, and like a lot of people from that era, he thought, wow, we're really going to make a difference in the world. And then you fast forward 40 years later, and you look at the self-absorbed world that we've become, you know?
Yes.
The people walking down the street staring into their iPhones and what have you, people online talking to complete strangers, they won't make eye contact with another person on the sidewalk, the ridiculous crap that passes for entertainment on television. I mean, I think, you know, politics, I think that's why he feels that way. He's like, you know what, I thought we were going to change, things were going to get better, but you know, they really haven't. They seem to have gotten a lot worse.
Well, not only that.
Maybe that's just why you put it.
Well, the worst culprits, especially from his point of view, were his own generation. I mean,
yeah. They
were the ones who set it all in motion it's all opinion, but I mean, I'm sure he would agree that they dropped the ball, you know?
Sure.
So it's very much the idea of him looking around and saying, what happened to this world that we thought we were going to create, and we basically became the enemy, literally.
And you know what, though? I look at George Romero, this may be a reach, but I think George Romero keeps making his films with these messages, and whether they become harsher and harsher. It's the same reason somebody like Joan Baez still goes and performs. You know what I mean? There are a handful of them out there that still believe in that hippie ethic, or that the belief, you know, we say hippie now and it's an insult or it's a joke or whatever, but you know, there are still a handful of those people that, you know, they still believe in that. They believe in, and that's why he continues making his movies. Joan Baez plays concerts for 30 people, whoever's going to show up at them, because they still have, you know, they still think, maybe someone's really going to get this before I croak. I don't know.
Yeah, it's about the cause and not so much, it's the message and the cause, it's not so much how much money they're going to make off of it.
Right, exactly.
And that's why George...
Could have sold out years ago. Did you guys ever hear the story about Sharon Stone and George Romero? Did you ever hear that story?
No.
No, please inform me, though. I'm interested.
I don't know all the details, and maybe one of your listeners will know better or whatever, but the way I understand it, it was right before Bruiser, okay? He apparently, now whether it was the Bruiser script, I'm not sure, but he had a script, and Sharon Stone, someone gave her a copy of the film, and she apparently said, I want to do this, and Romero was getting major backing from a studio because of this, and you know, papers were signed, and sets were being built, and what have you, and everything, and Sharon Stone's like, yeah, we're going to do it, Romero was told that he would have final cut, what have you, and then at the last minute, Sharon Stone backed out. I'm sorry, can't do it, got something else came up, you know. I don't know, I guess she was making Fatal, Basic Instinct Part 2 or something, you know, some other fabulous movie. She backed out, he lost the funding, the studio said, sorry, no way, and I remember, this would have been 2000 maybe, around then.
Yeah, Bruiser came out in 2000.
Anyway, but I remember he had a website at the time, and I just remember this diatribe. He just went on this diatribe. You see, imagine you're working with a certain actress. I won't mention any names, but, you know, somebody like Sharon Stone, and he must have mentioned her name 4 or 5 times. I often wonder, you know, if that, I don't know if you've ever seen Bruiser.
Yes, I saw it when it first came out.
No, never.
Okay, and you know, there's the heartbeat wife. I wonder if that was Sharon Stone's part, and would the movie have been a lot better? You know, because not just because Sharon Stone was in it, but because you know he would have had a lot more things at his disposal. And I just think that's interesting. If I ever met him, I say, come on, man, spill the beans. What did you know? What did Sharon Stone do to you? Really, come on. You know, I want to hear it. You know, so it'd be kind of cool to hear that story.
That's great.
He's been burned by Hollywood. I mean,
yes.
Apparently even when he did do Bruiser, that was when Orion had that, the studio, and then they took it from him and they recut it.
Yeah, I mean, he can't catch a break in Hollywood at all, and these days he completely exists outside of the Hollywood system.
Yeah, and yet, have you ever noticed when he does work with real actors and actresses, like when he did Creepshow, and he's working with some legitimate actors and actresses, I think he coaxed some incredibly great performances.
Oh, God, Leslie Nielsen is beyond belief in that movie.
Oh, my God, I can't hold my breath. I love him in that. But I think Adrian Barbeau in The Crate, that whole scenario,
yeah,
is beyond brilliant. Okay, now see, this is where my gay gene is really going to come into focus here. When I saw that movie, that vignette, The Crate, just reminds me of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with that. Yes, you have this lousy alcoholic, you know, wife of a college professor, you know, and she's just, except this time, you know, it's not just going to end at a night of them drinking and screaming at each other. You know, she's going to get what she deserves. And I know Stephen King wrote that. It wasn't from Romero's pen. But I for some reason, I just feel like Romero coaxed that out of her. So it's like, go ahead, you know, put her on, put her
I think so too. I mean, it doesn't happen often. I mean, even which one was it? Land of the Dead. Okay. Now that was his big comeback, and he had more money behind him. That was Universal, if I'm not mistaken. He had more money behind him than he had in a really long time, you know. And he made his most cynical zombie movie up until that point. I mean, I liked it, but I remember walking out of it thinking, "Wow, that was really harsh." I mean, the idea behind that movie is that we do not belong on this planet. And that's
I think that was also his, you know, that was his suffering, maybe just take on the whole, the George Bush years, you know, I mean, look at the Dennis Hopper.
Well, Dennis Hopper character, right, yeah.
Well, to me, the Dennis Hopper character was one part George Bush and one part Donald Trump, you know, and,
Well, he actually said.
Also, that movie, I think the thing that always fascinated me was that the movie kind of predicted the end of the middle class, you know, you had the poor and you had the super wealthy, you know. And there was no middle class anymore, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Well, he actually says, Hopper actually says, we do not negotiate with terrorists in the movie, which was perfect. But yeah, that was the one where basically we're supposed to sympathize. It was interesting to me because, you know, we're supposed to sympathize with these zombie characters like Big Daddy and all of his minions and everything.
Of course you are.
And yet when they get to the city, it's not like they behave any differently than any other zombies in any other Romero movie. It's not like they suddenly decide to extend an olive branch. They behave exactly like any other zombies in any Romero movie, which is they kill everybody.
Yes!
It's really dark, you know?
Don't laugh, it's supposed to happen.
Well, he's come a long way, but it's interesting, too, how after that movie, I really feel like people don't know what, meaning studios, they don't know what to expect from him, because you'll notice, like, he got all this money behind him for Land of the Dead with Universal. Now, I'm sure that it did not perform up to expectations. I'd be willing to bet money on that, financially speaking. Now, then you get to the next one, Diary of the Dead, right?
Diary of the Dead, yeah.
It's a much smaller release. It's the Weinstein Company. It's much more modest. Now, then, by the time you get to Survival of the Dead, it's practically direct to DVD. So it's almost like, you know, he's got this loyal fan base, but it's not enough to really support him as a mainstream filmmaker, unfortunately.
Well, you know, Brian, I think if you just looked down the street and you just asked 30 or 40 complete strangers, do you know who George Romero is? I think less than half of them are going to know who you're talking about.
That's true.
Now,
that makes me very sad, Pax.
What's that?
I said, that makes me very sad.
I know it's sad, but I mean, when I leave the realm of my horror blog and everything, and I go out in the real world, I tend to talk a lot about this stuff, and I work in a field where I'm surrounded by some very intelligent people, and I'll drop a name, and I'll say a George Romero, and I'll get a blank look, and I'll say, you never saw Night of the Living Dead? What? Wow! So, I don't, you know, he doesn't, it's not, you know, it's not like seeing Steven Spielberg or
right.
or whoever, so you've got that against him, number one, you know, and the guys holding the money are, I don't know, I think they're going to be less than, willing to part with it, especially when they did, like you said, when they did give him money to create, you know, Land of the Dead, it didn't really take off, but didn't that also go into, wasn't that a limited release? Also, I mean, did it get a big mainstream release? I can't remember.
So which one?
The Land of the Dead.
Land of the Dead got a full release, as far as I know. I mean, it had...
Okay, all right.
Yeah, it had Universal behind it. It was in all of your multiplexes and everything.
Right.
I had to. I saw that at my neighborhood multiplex, but I had to go to Manhattan to see Diary of the Dead. I had to go to an art house to find it. Yeah, and Survival of the Dead. I wound up getting a bootleg of it at a convention, allegedly.
Yeah, I saw Land of the Dead. I saw Diary of the Dead and Land of the Dead at the same theater. I don't know if you guys are familiar, but in South Jersey, Philadelphia area, for a very short period of time, we had the Ritz, and it was multiplexes, but they would show independent films.
And no, it wasn't.
Make a lot of money. It was called the Ritz, and theaters. They didn't make a lot of money. Now they're called Rave, and they showed the Transformers. performers and everything, and maybe one independent film. But anyway, it was at one of the Ritz theaters. I saw Land of the Dead and Diary of the Dead. Granted, the Diary of the Dead, I think, played maybe 4 days and was gone.
Yeah.
And Survival of the Dead, I saw Through the Kindness of a Stranger. That's how I saw it. But after I watched it that way, I did buy a copy. I bought a Blu-ray of it because I enjoyed it so much.
Yep,
I really did as well.
I did as well.
If you don't mind, I want to go back for just a quick second and just leave the zombies alone for a minute.
Please do.
Can I do that?
Yep, you may.
Okay.
I'll let it slide this time. I said I'll let it slide this time.
All right, just this one time. There's something else I have to mention when we're talking about Romero, because I just need for people that are interested in his movies and have not seen other than, you know, the zombie movies, which we can talk about, you know, for a long time, is I'm really hoping that people seek out Martin.
Yes.
Because in my humble opinion, zombie movies notwithstanding, that is his masterpiece. That is, to me, and when we talked about him having a social conscience and looking at the world around him, every time I watch Martin, and I watch it twice a year, it's really strange, I watch it in the spring and I watch it again around Halloween, I'm always struck with how that movie was such a snapshot of an era. You have the story of this young man who thinks he's a vampire. Clearly he's suffering from delusions, mental health issues, but it seemed to me it was the beginning of Romero looking and seeing, well, things really aren't working out the way, you know, like we were talking about the earlier, things really aren't working out the way we wanted them to. Number one, we had the death of the city in this, the Pittsburgh, it wasn't really Pittsburgh, but wherever they were in one of the Rust Belt cities in Pennsylvania. You see this entire city being bled dry, ha-ha, as if, you know, vampires came in, and, you know, you see, the end of religion being important. I don't know if you remember, but when everyone goes to the Catholic Church in the neighborhood, they're in this burnt out building. You know, half the building's gone. They don't have the money yet to rebuild it, so that's where they're having their services at. You have the women in this movie are such victims of circumstance. You've got Christine Romero playing Martin's cousin. She wants to get out of town. The only way she can do it, she has to latch on to Tom Savini's character, who's a no-good-for-nothing, so she has to compromise. And then you've got the other woman. I don't know the actress's name, but she plays Mrs. Santelli, and that's who Martin ends up having an affair with. And she's this very wealthy woman who lives outside of town. She has everything in the world you could possibly imagine, but she's unhappy. She feels like, you know, she didn't get what she thought she would get out of life. She ends up committing suicide. You have Martin's cousin, who still believes in the old ways and the mumbo-jumbo, and is trying to heal his cousin through magic and religion, and nothing's working for anybody. You know, everything that people had put their faith in is gone. Whether they put their faith in the economy, whether they put their faith in the church, whether they put their faith into the women's movement. Even Martin, who puts his faith that I'm a vampire, in that mythical faith, everything just fails them. And I just, every time I watch that movie, I'm just blown away by all of this, all of these messages, and seeing how, look at how the 60s died bleeding. You know, and this is when we came into the early 70s, this is what we got. You know, so just something that I really hope people seek this movie out. And again, you know, you're going to go in thinking, wow, this is a horror movie. It's really not a horror movie.
Right, it's not.
You know, it's not. It's a lot more. But just a personal thing of mine.
Well, it's
I got to meet John Amplis at the MonsterCon, or whatever it was, last March.
Oh, did you?
And I talked the poor guy's ear off because I was like, wow, I'm so glad to meet you. You know, it was kind of cool to meet him who played Martin.
Well, okay. I think that's probably Romero's, God, I mean, it's probably, it might be his most well-known film, Creepshow might be. I was going to say other than the zombie films, but I would hasten to say it might be the movie that he's actually the most proud of.
Yeah, and rightly so, yeah.
It comes up a lot in interviews with him and things like that, and I think you can tell that it has a soft spot in his heart, you know? And he did have a lot to say in that film, and he says it in a much more direct way, even than in a lot of the zombie movies.
Right.
Because the zombie movies are a lot more about kind of allegory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like the whole consumerism thing in Dawn of the Dead, and you know, kind of the Reagan era stuff in Day of the Dead. It's all very kind of veiled. And I think one thing, and God, we can talk about this all night, but one thing I did want to leave off with, though, is that it's interesting to me, and it's kind of a sad statement, how it was a lot easier, I think, in the earlier days of his career for him to make those kind of movies, even if he had to make them his own way, it was easier for him to get them made and to get them distributed, whereas now a filmmaker like him, with opinions like he does, and with messages in his films, and the type of content, he runs into so many more roadblocks and obstacles now, whether it's the ratings board, whether it's distribution, whether it's financing, that he didn't used to run into as much, and it's kind of sad.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, yeah. But, I think it was a lot easier for a lot of, Scorsese was starting at the same time, and a lot of other guys, you know, to get, you know, to get their things off the ground, you know, and like you said, some of them worked out, some of them did not, but I think no matter what you say about Romero, you know, whether it was a successful career or non-successful or whatever, I wouldn't rate him by that. I said earlier, this is a guy that changed the face of modern horror, and you can't take that away from him no matter what you do.
No,
and
not at all. No.
He's also created, you know, three or four terrific films, you know, Living Dead and Martin and Dawn of the Dead, which is probably that is the ultimate zombie movie. Yeah. And I don't care who offended by saying this, but that remake from a few years ago just sucked. I went in with an open mind, and I basically just said, "Fuck everybody involved with this mess." they lost me because they dropped the ball on everything. I mean, why even bother having this scene in the mall if you're not going to go for what the point was in the first place? Oh, the zombies are going to run. That's great. Okay, so now we've got running zombies and frantic camera work, and it really bothered me.
Well, my take on that and on the Dawn of the Dead remake, if we can open the can of worms up, is that I'm it's not as harsh as your viewpoint. I went in very negatively. The opposite of you. I went in like just
disgusted,
just angry, and I wound up liking it. Maybe that's why I wound up liking it more than I would have now. It's nowhere near the film as the original, and it's a completely different kind of film. I kind of admire, and I'm not a fan of fast moving zombies, but that's a whole other thing.
That's a whole subject.
but I at least respected that they didn't try to top Romero's movie. It's like they went in a totally different direction. Now, yes, they surgically removed all of the intelligence and social commentary that was in Romero's movie, and it's a very different kind of movie. And
right.
The shopping mall is it's almost like, in a way, the movie actually falls into the trap that Romero is warning against, which is like they're in a mall, but they're showing you how cool it is that they're in a mall. It's not, you know, it's not about any of the consumerism, and also none of the characters, and this is my problem with the fast versus slow, is that none of the characters have enough internal monologue going on to even stop and talk about or ponder what the hell is happening. Like, there isn't any of that kind of, like, what's going on? Why is this happening? What are we going to do? It's just, there's no...
There was that scene in the original, where was that famous JCPenney scene, I call it, when they're standing there, and he says, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth, you know, and he does that whole explanation, why do they come here, it's important to them, you know, that was all gone.
Nobody even bothers to ask, why is this happening? It's just sort of like, okay, I woke up in the morning, there's zombies everywhere, they're trying to kill me, so I guess I just better figure out a way to survive. Like, you would think it was just like a bad traffic jam or something. Like, nobody ever says, what the hell is going on, you know?
Nothing at all, nothing at all.
But I did enjoy it. It's a popcorn movie. The original Dawn of the Dead is not a popcorn movie, but this one is.
No, that Dawn of the Dead remake, I liked it better when it was called 28 Days Later.
Yes, But 28 Days Later is a lot better. 28 Days Later is a great, great film.
It's a terrific film because they weren't zombies.
Right.
Or infected, I can give you that. Okay, that's cool. You know, also, I think Shaun of the Dead was probably, out of everybody, you know, I was kind of at the dawn of all this, you know, but I think Shaun of the Dead was an absolute, I think it was a loving homage to what Romero did.
Yes.
You know, to his work. But that movie I absolutely loved. Because the zombies were still, as much as it was a comedy and everything was played for laughs, the zombies were still terrifying.
Yes.
You know, there was still a feeling of dread in that film.
And I will stand by what I've said, that I think of all the whole zombie renaissance of the last 10 years, that movie, which ironically is a parody, is the best one of them all.
Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Oh, I loved it. I remember I went with a friend of mine to see it, and she was mortified because, you know, she told her own to see a comedy, and she, and, you know, it was funny, but she just kept hiding her eyes. I'm like, God, I can't stand this.
Well, I remember telling people who had no affinity for horror films, and just saying, you know, you would, or women, you know, and just who would normally, honestly go and see a chick flick, you know, not to generalize, but it's the truth. And I would say, you know, you will actually dig this movie. It's actually a legit romantic comedy. It just happens, and it's very funny, and it's very romantic. It just happens to have zombies in it, and that's it. And they all loved it. Everybody I recommended it to, even people that would never go see a horror movie, wound up enjoying it.
It was genius, definitely.
Well, Pax, we could all talk about zombies and George Romero all night, but I think I should probably draw this amazing edition of Conversations in the Dark to a close right about now. I want to thank you, though, very much for giving us so much of your time. I think this might be the longest one that I've ever done.
And it just cut out all the crap, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just going to... Everything you said...
Everything I said, and you'll have a great show.
There is no crap.
No filler. I really enjoyed talking about all this stuff and getting to hear the voice behind the luchador mask. So thanks a whole lot. And again, Pax Romano is the...
This was a blast. I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed it.
And be sure to check out Billy Loves Stew, which is Pax's blog. It's a great read. And if you haven't, you really should. Pax is one of the best out there.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Pax.
Bye, Pax.
Okay, bye-bye.